And yet that's exactly what Lewis does, his eyes drawn to the only light in the room. He immediately turns away, blinking hard, trying to restore his eyes. Eventually the shape of the basement takes form, and he can see the two men creeping away from him. He yanks his gun from his holster and follows. Every step is uncertain, the ground pulpy from guano and brittle with bones. They cannot be as quiet as they hope to be. To get to the far side of the room, they must pass beneath the bats, many of them man-size. Their faces are snouted and deeply wrinkled. Their claws latch to the rafters, and their wings surround them like a veined chrysalis. The ceiling is tall enough to leave 3 feet of space beneath them. Lewis ducks down to pass beneath them. He has never felt so vulnerable, with the bats hanging above them as if they might spear his bent back. By the time he gets past them, the others are already hunched over Clark. She is not moving except as they shake her. Her clothes are torn, her neck and wrists and thighs gashed. Where her skin isn't bloody, it is alabaster pale. They do not know where to check for a pulse, with her neck and wrists opened, but Lewis leans his face into hers and detects a shallow breath. She lives. The bats have kept her to bleed until emptied. They move as slowly as they can, Reed getting behind her, looping his arms beneath her shoulders, York gripping her by the knees. Lewis takes the lantern. Bones stir and snap. They pause at every noise, waiting for the bats to wake. When they duck down, beneath maybe a dozen bats altogether, their hanging forms a mob of all different sizes, Reed and York steal forward in small steps, backs bent by the weight of Clark. Lewis follows in a hunch. He moves more slowly than they do. He toes aside a bone. He slides his boot through a pile of black guano. He can feel a breeze, their breath against his neck. He keeps the lantern low. In his hand, it feels like a small sun, its light too bright, no matter how spare the wick. Reed and York already have Clark at the base of the stairs. Lewis tries to concentrate on them. He tries not to look up, but then he senses some movement in his peripheral vision and cannot help himself. A bat hangs beside him, and one of its ears is twitching. Maybe because it hears him. Or maybe because it tracks some prey through the night sky of its sleep, its ears spasming like the legs of a dreaming dog. Its mouth opens and closes with a damp sound. Its eyes shudder beneath wrinkled lids. Ahead he can see Clark dragged through the air, over the ledge, the rope cinched beneath her armpits. He can see the rope fall again and Reed hoisting himself up. York looks back and waves impatiently. Lewis wakes from his fearful daze and takes another step forward. A bone shatters beneath his foot. In the silence of the basement, the sound is tremendous, as though the very darkness has cracked open. He looks down to see it was a femur. He looks up to see the bat's eyes snap open. They are huge and white and gelatinous. Then comes the chittering sound, at first only from its mouth, and then from the others waking all around him. He hears his name. Lewis? Reed is calling for him, and he is stumbling toward his voice. Lewis! The doorway hangs above, his body a black silhouette against the gray light of it. Lewis! There is a rustling behind him, like a wind sweeping across a desk stacked with paper, and then a shotgun blast from York. The clap and crash of it fills his ears and seems to shake the very foundation of the house. He throws down the lantern and it shatters, and he staggers and trips and catches the rope and uses it to right himself. York fires again and says, "Go, go, go, go!" He clambers up, one hand over the other, the rope pinched between his thighs. In this way he inches toward the doorway. He is weak enough and slow enough that Reed knows to help, dragging him the rest of the way. The splintery lip of the hardwood scrapes his belly raw. He is out, among their legs. He scrabbles forward, and in that moment, moving from darkness into light, he feels as he did as a child, returning from the toilet at night, leaping into bed, certain that a hand with sharp black fingernails would snatch hold of his ankle. For a second, he can't help but stare at Clark. She lies in the hallway, as still as a corpse. The doctor kneels beside her and hauls her body toward the daylight. Lewis is roused by the screaming above him, of Reed encouraging York to hurry, goddammit, and the screaming below. Lewis rises from the floor, In the basement, the shotgun fires, and he sees in its sunburst the bats crowding around York, and when it fires for the second time, he sees a spray of blood. He sees tattered wings and cratered chests. The rope goes taut. York is climbing. Reed fires his revolvers repeatedly into the darkness with a sound like storms crashing against each other, warring for the sky. Lewis grabs hold of the rope and heaves again. First the boy's hands and then his face appear at the bottom of the doorway. He is smiling. Blood speckles his face. His feet dangle in a cavernous dark, but he is alive. And for this, he can't help but smile crookedly. Just as he stands upright, the doorway behind him fills with the white blur of a bat, and before his smile can die, one of its wings curls around him. It draws him back, drawing him down into the dark, but his hand shoots out and catches the doorway, and he holds fast there. It is then that a voice calls out, a throaty, ash-edged voice none of them recognizes, yelling, "No!" Joea. Her face seems to have cracked open, revealing for the first time actual feeling, raw panic. "Leave him alone!" She rushes forward and shoves her rifle into the bat's open mouth and fires. The fire catches easily. It begins with the lantern Lewis dropped. Reed adds to it by sparking a match against a bookcase, a lace curtain, a dried bunch of grass beneath the porch. The flames thrash. The smoke rushes from the windows, streaming upward as fast as water, the streams gathering into the dark lake pooling above. Timbers snap, nails and screws come loose with pings and pops. Hardly 10 minutes pass before the house is overcome by a snapping peak of fire, the orange bones of its timbers barely visible through the flames. He and York and Joea step back, and step back again. The air warps and ripples with the heat. They stare into it, the light so painfully bright, with their guns still at their sides. They might see figures writhing within, but they might not. The fires dance, like the desert's mirage, sometimes gives you what you want. Lewis does not notice. All of his attention is focused on Clark. He wipes the blood from her face. Her skin is the yellow white of dough. Her neck and her wrists and thighs have been torn by fangs. The flesh there swollen into purplish-white mounds, scabbed at their crowns. The doctor brought her leather satchel. It is split open beside her now, and she withdraws from it wipes, gauze, a short bottle of sugar, a tall bottle of clear alcohol. The breeze rises to a wind that carries smoke and dust. She sets to work cleaning the wounds and instructs Lewis to prop up Clark's head and spoon some sugar water into her mouth. He barely hears her. "That won't be enough," he says.
"We'll do what we can, and that's all we can do."
She's lost too much blood. Her voice sounds very far away when she says,
"Yes."
He thinks about what York said to him that morning. Why didn't he do anything when the bats descended on their camp? Raise his arms and let loose a flash of light and make everything better. Lewis didn't have an adequate answer. Because he doesn't like what he doesn't understand, what he can't label and quantify, because it makes him feel inhuman, because his father made him afraid of himself? He feels a heat, first mistaken for the fire crackling behind him. But this comes from inside him. His chest feels tornadic, a blistering wind caught behind his ribs. He swells with it until he knows he must find an outlet or else incinerate. Embers swirl at the edge of his vision. There is no stopping it this time. The doctor's face creases. She takes several steps back, telling Lewis to settle down, holding out her hands as if to block something hurled at her. He feels too full, as if his skin might break and release a flood of energy, and he knows where to release it, recognizes the gaping emptiness inside Clark that must be filled. He reaches into the doctor's satchel and removes a scalpel. With it, he traces his wrist and then rips into it. He holds his arm over Clark's. His blood puddles onto her, and then, slowly, it begins to siphon into her wound, the gash trembling at the edges like a grateful mouth. He feels separate from himself when he presses their wrists together. It is a compulsive act, as when the proboscis of a butterfly sinks into a flower, Their bodies know what to do. She draws the blood into her, sucking, sucking, until he feels the last corner of his body emptying. His eyes are closed. He may hear screaming. At last he pulls away from her and discovers the others standing around them, watching him with fear and revulsion. Except for Joea. She steps forward.
"Burr was right," she says. "You are like me."
Clark stirs. Her skin has gone from pale to a flushed pink. Her back arches. Her stomach heaves. She turns her head and something hot surges up her throat, escaping her with an oily black splatter. A fly lands at its edge to taste of it and immediately expires. Her eyes tremble open, just as his fall shut. Chapter 20. Joea is different. She has always known she was different, like a baby raised among wolves, and this difference came with a lifelong sense of separation, loneliness. Loneliness is what she knows best. She was born into it. After the men swept a knife across her father's throat and smashed his face into the snow, after the men dragged her mother and midwife into the night and through the whirling storm, after dawn came and revealed the snow-swept ruins of the village, Joea remained alone in the bed she was born in, alternately squalling and sleeping. Her cries eventually brought her Oma. She was injured, her gray hair clotted at the temple where the men had struck her twice. But when she shrank into a corner, they left her there, so old she must have already looked dead enough to them. Oma stood over the bed, where Joea rested in a nest of blankets, and wept. She cried for the village, much of it burned to ashes, and she cried for her daughter, dead or kidnapped, and she cried for this grandchild of hers, born with a pair of eyes that matched the night-black world. Deformities are normal. Some are born with extra fingers and toes, others with diminutive limbs, crooked spines, birthmarks brightly staining their faces. In their village, a child was born without any mouth, only a slitted nose, and without any genitals, just a fleshy mound where there might have been a cleft or a shaft. Another child, a boy with gigantism, was cut from his mother's belly after only 7 months because they worried his kicks might shatter her ribs. He was born as big as a toddler. He lived and grew to be twice as tall as any man in the village, with a shelf of a forehead and spiked, uneven shoulders, but died before he was 20. Some say his heart couldn't keep up with all that body. And then there was Denver, more than 100 miles away, nicknamed the Goblin City. A warhead detonated there, mangling the downtown and opening up a crater so big it appeared half the city had been scooped by a giant shovel. The buildings glowed at night, some said, as did the people, all of them with skin like melted wax and hair that grew in patches, their mouths hissing a language no one understood but them. Joea was a kind of goblin. When she was 2 and did not want to go to bed, Oma told her, the lantern shattered and licked the floor with a tongue of fire. When she was 3, she could whistle and call a bird fluttering from a branch to her shoulder. When she was 4, she began to work in their garden, and the vegetables grew oversize, and the flowers remained in bloom through the fall. When she was 5 and wandered away from the cabin alone, Oma spanked her and woke up the next morning covered with hundreds of spider bites. Oma read stories to her, played games with her, taught her how to sew and knit and cook, how to gut a fish, butcher an elk, and though Joea could talk in a tiny, calm voice, she never asked questions, only gave answers. Sometimes it seemed she had another way of communicating with the world, plugged into a connection unavailable to the rest of them. And more than once, Oma found herself fetching a cup of water that Joea reached for eagerly, though she never asked for it. Oma kept a picture of her daughter, Juliana, a charcoal sketch, the frame stained darkly along the right side from all the time she spent holding it in her hand. Sometimes she and Joea went hunting, not for deer or elk or bear, but for information about the men who had come in the night. They found other villages scorched and riddled with bones. Sometimes dried-out corpses hung from trees like cocoons, and sometimes spears bristled the ground, their tips topped by skulls. They found survivors, mostly old men and women, who told them about a long parade of wheeled cages crammed with men and women and children.
"Which way did they go?"
"That way," the old man said, pointing north. "Or maybe that way, west."
"Thank you,"
Oma said, and the old man said,
"I wouldn't go that way. I'd stay as far away as you can from there. There's a darkness rising."
Then Oma died. Her glands swelled in her armpits, below her jaw, into lumps. What they knew must be cancer. She became feverish. Her sweat smelled like sulfur. She lost her appetite and slept most of the day and thinned to a skeleton with loose, papery skin. After Joea buried her in the backyard, she remained by the hump of dirt for hours, and the sky steadily filled with shrieking birds. The birds always listened. There was nothing for her here. Her sense of aloneness was so complete, so consuming, that the rest of the world blurred away, and there was only her mother's face sketched in charcoal. Her Oma believed her alive. So did Joea. She was sad and scared, but Oma taught her what she needed to know to live. And she was 14 now, not a woman, but the beginning of one. She hiked across Colorado and into Utah, and in her pack she carried the sketch. When she smelled smoke, when she happened upon trails that carried footprints and wheel ruts, when she spotted lamplight flaring through the woods, she watched for a long time before she approached. Sometimes people fired arrows or threw rocks at her, and sometimes they talked, though none seemed eager to offer much of themselves to the black-eyed girl. Many told stories about the slavers, about the wagon trains driven west, about the drumbeats they sometimes heard that took over their pulse and made them fear the night and what it might bring. The high-walled valley was a bowl of fissured clay, empty of anything except a single boulder deposited there by a glacier. The boulder was pocked and red and round, its own tiny planet. She rested in the shade of it. The day was so hot, her lungs felt scalded. She was in Utah, near Salt Lake City, or so she believed from studying her map. She snacked on beef jerky, smoked fish. She drank from her canteen, then spared a few drops to make mud on her palm to spread on her sunburn. She took off her hat and fanned her face and gave up when she felt no relief. She curled up, hoping to sleep, to hike again after the sunset. She did not notice, a long way off, near the neck of the valley, a ribbon of dust dirtying the sky, kicked up by a caravan of oxen and carts. Nor did she notice the trembling in the ground. Their slow progress matched the sun. It was as if they were pacing each other, both of them rolling along for the next hour, the sun centering the sky just as the first of the carts heaved to a stop beside the boulder. It was too late to hide. The nightmare parade consisted of 20 cages, some built from wood and barbed wire, many of them repurposed truck beds with cages welded over the top, each dragged by two rib-slatted horses or oxen that foamed with sweat and bled at the yokes. The wheels of their caravan cut deep furrows in the clay. Men and women and children peeked out of the cages. Their lips were cracked and bleeding. Those with white faces were a mess of peeling, reddened skin. A few muttered and sobbed, but most observed her silently. The boulder offered the only shade in the valley, and burrowed beneath rested a jeweled nest of lizards and snakes. One of them rattled its tail now, and the rest joined in, making a sound like a storm of gravel. The man in the lead cart wore cracked sunglasses and a round-brimmed hat with what looked like a bite taken out of it. His beard had a white streak waterfalling down its middle.
"Well, well."
The rattling faded. "Snake, my snake." He dropped down stiffly from his perch. His boots shattered the crisp patina, and a dust cloud rose and breezed away. He jerked a knife from his belt and stepped toward her, ready for trouble. She trembled, cast down her eyes.
"She long?"
said one of the other drivers.
"Looks it."
The man smelled unwashed, and she breathed in the thick, oily flavor of him. She wanted to run, but this was what she had been looking for, wasn't it? By finding them, she might find her mother. The man nudged up her chin, and it was only then that he noticed her eyes, black and empty, watching him. He took a step back.
"What?"
the other driver asked.
"Something wrong with her."
"Not so wrong. Throw her in."
He hesitated only a second before grabbing her by the hair and dragging her to the bed of a Toyota. He unlocked the tailgate and forced her inside. Bars reached over the truck bed like a metal ribcage with a threadbare tarp thrown over for shade. It snapped in the wind, and a triangle of sunlight flashed the 10 people huddled there. Some of the men and women didn't move, slack-faced and staring into a middle distance available only to them. Others tried to comfort her, telling her, "It's all right, dear." Though they pulled away hesitantly when they noticed her eyes. One of them pressed a baby to a flattened breast. The man dug through her pack. He tossed aside what he didn't want. In his hand was the picture of her mother, the framed charcoal sketch. He studied her mother's face a moment before letting the wind carry her away. Soon the caravan groaned forward again, the wheels cutting through the baked skin of the valley floor, hushing the sand beneath. They continued through the day, into the night, and they entered a rockier territory. The truck bed tipped one way, then the other, knocking them about. There was a jug of water that sloshed violently. Now and then they drank from it, everyone saying, "Take care, take care. Who knows when they'll refresh it?" Jawea took three little sips before the jug was yanked from her. Some of the men and women were bone thin, and some were heavy, with arms that slopped and folded over each other many times. All of them were dust-smeared. Mostly they huddled in stunned silence, but occasionally they wondered aloud where they would be taken, what would happen to them. "I heard about them," the woman with the baby said. "Heard they were coming. Man came through and warned us. Said he had seen one of their hives with his own two eyes. That's what he called it. Not a city, not a town, but a hive. As if they weren't people. Not in a standard sense. Not with hearts and minds. Just a bunch of bugs with pinchers and stingers." A skeletal man with a broken nose was nodding when she spoke. When she finished, he said he had heard stories, too. About men on horseback with whips looped at their belts and rifles holstered at their sides, overseeing slaves as they felled trees, graded roads, dug irrigation canals, raised barns, built fences. They were building something, trying to put the world back together again, and treating people like the tools to make it happen.
"That's us. That's what we're gonna be to them."
"Not me,"
a heavy woman with a red face said.
"I'm nobody's tool."
"I guess we'll see about that."
They kept on with their talking, and Jawea found her eyes drawn to the cratered face of the moon and the stars that pricked the sky. She got lost in their depths, as if falling into a pond full of quartz. Somehow, despite their lurching passage, they all eventually drifted to sleep. The next morning, the baby did not wake. The mother wailed for half the day before going quiet. Jawea watched her clutch the baby and felt a renewed hollowness, an inversion of her own pain in the mother's. A week later, the air changed. She could smell the water from a long way off, the mineral sharpness of it, like the tears of a stone. Where before there was no road, they now followed the pocked and rutted tracks of others, a narrow chute between two ridges. When they passed through the other side of it, big pines clustered, their cones crunching underfoot, their branches scraping metal. The shade pooled, the temperature dropped 20 degrees. Through the pine needles, the sunlight filtered green. The men and women, who said nothing for days, now pressed their faces against the bars and chirped with excitement at the green bunches of bear grass, the red splash of Indian paintbrush. The sun, which had pressed down on them for so long, now felt worlds away. Then the pine resin and sage gave way to the smell of smoke, cooked meat. Their smiles flattened. They passed a dented green sign whose white lettering read, Ashton, population 10,272. Once, there was an asphalt road here, buckled and broken and made impassable, but the mess of it had been cleared away into a cinder grade. They passed a white steepled church, a blacksmith, a mercantile, all of them newly constructed, freshly painted. The trees opened up, making room for the sun. A garden, planted with rows of lettuce and carrots and onions and potatoes, reached a square acre. A man sat on a horse beside it. A rifle rested across his lap. Below him, 10 boys and 4 girls leaned on hoes, watching them pass with the same blank expression as the cattle that crowded up against the fence of a slatted pen. The carts rolled past a man at a pump, jacking the metal arm of it, splashing full a bucket. He shaded his eyes to watch them pass. And here was the open garage of what was once a mechanic, now a carpentry shop. A man stood between 2 sawhorses and carved a tool along a length of wood, dirtying the floor with yellow shavings, making what appeared to be a door. A boy with a broom swept up the mess, his ankles chained loosely. In the center of town was a park, and through the park purled a river. The spring-fed water ran clear, except where it made a white collar along a broad shoal built from melon-sized stones. Several women crouched in the water foaming with soap. With brushes, they scrubbed at laundry before hanging it from wooden racks to dry upon the shore. Their ankles were chained, too. The caravan pulled into the roundabout of an old, yellow-bricked elementary school, and there he was, waiting for them on the front step. A thin man, bald and goosenecked, with a notebook and pen. He was smiling wanly. He, with the help of the drivers, unloaded every cage and examined every slave. That's what they were now, slaves. The heavy woman tried to pull away and got kicked to the ground and beaten with a cudgel. A boy cried, and one of the drivers cuffed him in the ear, and he cried all the louder. The thin man did not answer questions, but he asked them, "Have you had any illnesses? Have you had any children? Do you know any trades? Do you know how to cook? Do you know how to sew? Do you know how to garden?" And he commanded, "Open your mouth. Take off your clothes. Hold out your arms. Turn around in a circle." To Juwea, he said, "Is there something wrong with you?"
"No."
"I ask because your eyes. You don't have a tail or seizures? Any difficulties with language?"
"No."
"Hmm."
He made some notes on his clipboard and said, "Next," and sent her into the black mouth of the schoolhouse behind him. They branded her on the shoulder, along with the rest, her flesh sizzling, bunching up in a letter F and a number 131. They cleaned her, gave her fresh clothes, assigned her a bunk.
"You are now part of something bigger," the thin man told them. "You're serving a kind of collective, the rebirth of humanity, the reconstruction of the country. Your work matters. It's important. You're better off here. Forget your old lives. Forget what people used to call you. You're a tool now. You're a shovel. You're a hammer. You're a sickle. You're a trowel."
When the heavy woman tried to protest, the thin man nodded to some guards, and they dragged her out back and tied her to a post and lashed her with a whip 7 times. And after that, nobody said a word when told what to do. Everyone had a task. The job of the gardener was to raise and preserve food. The job of the tailor was to weave and sew and patch. The job of the slaver was to harvest slaves. In this way, town by town, or hive by hive, they multiplied, programming behavior, constructing a new world. Juwea was assigned to the hospital. When they told her what to do, she did it. It was easier that way, easier to focus on a task, scraping a broom across the floor and making a pile of dirt, knocking down cobwebs, mopping up puddles of blood. At first, it even felt welcome, curative. She had a place and function in the world. As long as she kept busy, she didn't have to think. Her head remained empty. Emptiness felt safe.
In this way, several days and then weeks passed. She washed trays of tools, scalpels, forceps, until they gleamed. She stripped the beds of sheets, collected towels and aprons from the floor, soiled with blood and shit and amniotic fluid.
"It won't be long," the thin man told her, "before you're ready for a child yourself."
Mostly, they left her alone. She had a way about her, a stillness even when moving, that didn't draw the eye. Today, she paused at the second-story window to observe a papery gray wasp's nest, half the size of her, dangling from a nearby branch. The black-bodied wasps, each the size of a finger, crawled across its outside, thrumming their wings. Then she went about tidying a cot, folding a blanket around a thin mattress stuffed with wool. She was in the pregnancy wing, and in the room rested three other women, all wearing shapeless gowns to accommodate their rounded stomachs. Two of them weren't much older than her, young enough to still look longingly at dolls. The other had gray threading her hair. They rubbed their hands across their bellies, sometimes clutching themselves, as if trying to strangle away the pain contracting there. Joya answered to the midwives, one of them a slit-mouthed, wide-hipped woman who always pointed a finger when she called out, "You!" before assigning some errand. Joya paused in the doorway of a room, where she found the midwives busy with a birth, drawing a squalling, purple-skinned baby from between a mother's legs, wiping it with a towel and laying it on the mother's chest before cutting the cord and sewing a tear and easing out the placenta and staunching the bleeding. In the next room, a woman paced the floor with her fists balled into the small of her back. Her eyes were closed, and her teeth bared. She breathed in a pattern of quick pants and long gusts. And in the room after, she found her mother, Juliana. Joya recognized her instantly. It was more than the framed picture her Oma carried around. Her mother was, after all, more than a decade removed from that charcoal likeness. Hollow-eyed, with thinning hair, yellowing skin, all these years and several births and so many years of hard labor later, no, the recognition was deeper, as if blood were magnetized. A baby suckled at her breast. It was curled like a shrimp into the nook of her arm. Its head was still coned from birth, its skin wrinkled and splotchy. Juliana was smiling, stroking its downy hair and humming a song that stopped short when she spied the girl.
"What do you want?"
"Mama."
"What are you talking about?"
"Mama."
Her voice was tiny and delicate, like a teacup rarely used.
"It's me. It's your daughter."
She hurried to the bed and laid a hand on her mother's. Something happened then. Ever since losing Oma, she felt closed down, locked away, unaware. Now, as she grabbed hold of her mother, it was as if two doors on either side of a house burst open and sent the wind rushing in and out, all of it mixed up with birds and bats and bugs and rain.
"Mama."
Juliana's eyes watered and her nostrils flared as if exposed to a whiff of alcohol that once made her sick.
"I don't know who you are. Get away from me. I said get away from me."
A scuff sound. In the doorway stood the slit-mouthed midwife. She was wiping her hands off with a towel that matched her shirt, patterned with blood.
"Get her away from me," Juliana said. "Get her away from my baby. She was trying to take it from me."
"No,"
Joya said.
"Mama."
The midwife threw down her bloody towel and started toward her, one of her hands already raised.
"Ma—"
The word was cut short by the fist that struck her. She fell to the floor and brought a hand to the hot swelling at her cheek. She looked up at Juliana with dribbling black eyes, only to see her mother's face twisted up in a snarl. The years had done something to her, distanced and polluted her. She had forgotten one family and become part of another.
"Stay away," she said. "You freak."
There was a sudden electrical hum. The air trembled like a wind first finding its breath. The midwife raised her hand again to strike her, but the hand never fell. A dark stream of wasps poured through the window, One moment the midwife was rearing back to strike Drawea, and the next moment she was seething with wings and stingers. They covered her completely, a nettling mass. She crashed into a wall, and then the floor. She tore at them, clawed at them. But like smoke, they parted a moment and then filled the space her hands passed through. Their bodies pulsed, jabbing their stingers again and again into every available surface of skin. And then, when the midwife opened her mouth to scream, they scrabbled down her throat. She was still thrashing on the floor when Juliana, over the storm of wasps, screamed, "Get away!" She wrapped the baby in a blanket now and clutched it two-handed. "Get away! Get away! Get away! Get away!" Juliana's expression hardened, as if all the anger and sadness and disappointment she might feel had mineralized, until it appeared someone had chipped her face from a piece of rock. She was about to ask the wasps something more. She was about to ask them to hurt the baby. If she concentrated hard enough, if she bent her desire into a question, she knew they would answer. But they stopped her. First the midwives, then the doctors. They stormed into the room and held her down and knocked her out, and she woke later in a barred cell with a swollen eye and a blackening headache. On the other side of the bars, she found the thin man studying her with his head cocked and his eyebrows arched. "You're awake." She rolled upright and brought a finger to her temple, and it came back tacky with blood.
"What are you going to do to me?"
"Me? Nothing."
"What's going to happen to me?"
"That's not my decision." "If it was my decision, I might slice you open and see what makes you tick. You make me very, very curious."
"Whose decision is it, then?"
"Aaron Burr's."
"Who's Aaron Burr?"
"Who's Aaron Burr?" The thin man laughed, a reedy clicking. "If you don't know that, then I better tell you the color of the sky and the name of the planet and the smell of a rose."
"Who is he?"
"You'll know soon enough. He wants to meet you. He wants me to take you to him."
Chapter 21. Once Ella learns where Simon lives, in a lean-to in an alley, she insists he stay with her.
"We'll head back to the doctor in a few days for a proper cast. In the meantime, we need to keep that wound clean. Judging from your clothes and your habit of crawling through sewers and sleeping with rats and trash, you're obviously incapable of taking care of yourself. You'll die, or they'll have to cut your arm off, and then you'll die."
So he will stay with her at the museum. In the room they share, there are two beds, and Ella sleeps in one, Simon the other. His forearm, now purplish with an angry red gash in the middle of it, has swollen to twice its size. His black, sausagey fingers will not respond to his commands. Twice a day she helps clean the wound and doses him up with morphine, but she does not permit him as much rest as he would like. She puts him to work instead, sweeping one-handed, scrubbing the bathroom, boxing up a butterfly display and replacing it with reptiles and amphibians. He is especially taken by a specimen of frog, called the hairy frog, or horror frog, skirted around the waist with fur and capable of breaking the bones in its fingers and toes in order to defend itself, forcing the shards through the skin, creating claws. He remembers the pain of the break and rubs his arm and imagines it as a newly carved weapon. He is a weapon. And if he could revenge his father, if he could hurt someone, slash his arm across a throat, it would be Slade. About this he spends a lot of time daydreaming, and about other things, too. Hunting dinosaurs with a spear, blasting off to space in a rocket, lancing a knight in a duel. Whereas before he spent all of his time trying to fill his stomach and filch valuables and escape detection, his every comfort is now attended to, and he can afford to indulge. The museum encourages his mind to play. For the first time in many years, he is allowed to be a child. When he asks for his backpack, Ella says, "Maybe later." And when he complains, she says, "You do what I tell you to do. I've got you by the balls, remember?" So he does as he's told. There seems to be no other way with her. Even when she uses the word please, it comes at a near shout,
But so does she make him meals, and mend his clothes, and cut his hair, the clippings of which collect in a thick nest on the floor when she circles his chair and scissors her way to his scalp, and finally stands back and nods approvingly and says, "You look much better now. Very presentable indeed, except for your stuck-out ears." He runs a hand across his bristling scalp. Without all that hair, he feels naked. She is good at making him feel that way, stripped, revealed, as if there is no hiding anything from her. It is then they hear a noise, the thudding of what at first sound like footsteps. She puts a hand to his mouth and says, "Shh." He shoves the hand away and says, "What?" And she returns the hand, muzzling him. She faces the dark hallway. Her scissors rasp open. And then the thudding comes again, and she recognizes the sound. Someone's at the front entrance. Simon pushes her hand away again, and this time she lets him talk when he says, "It's night. No one's supposed to be out." She closes the scissors with a snap. "Maybe we should ignore it," Simon says. But the thudding stubbornly continues, trembling the air. He stands from the chair. Cut curls fall from his shoulders and feather his feet. Ella pushes him back into a seated position. "You stay here." When he opens his mouth to protest, she points the scissors at him and says, "And whatever you do, don't make a sound." Sometimes it happens. Someone comes knocking late at night, usually the feeble-minded, the occasional drunk deep in his cups. Lewis will hiss and snap at them, burn them with a lantern, push them down the steps, send them scurrying off. But that was in the days before the enforced curfew, and now Lewis is not here to help. There is only her. The boy doesn't count. A broken-armed, thin-necked thief, he is as threatening as a gumming puppy. He is to be protected, not offer protection. She knows who it is. She wishes she didn't, but she does. She can feel him out there, in the same way the old-timers say they can feel storms. When she grips the scissors tightly and follows the staircase to the first floor and approaches the double doors, which shake in their frames. She waits there a long time, willing the sound to stop, but it won't. Not until she undoes the lock, opens a crack, peers out. In the darkness, in his black uniform, his face appears like a moon hovering over her. He presses a hand against the door to open it wider, but she presses back, giving him only these few inches, enough for him to see her unyielding expression.
"You took quite a long time to answer the door."
"I was busy."
"Doing what?"
"Sleeping."
"You sleep with the light on? I saw the light on."
"I was getting ready to go to sleep."
"Are you with someone?"
"No."
"I didn't have to knock, you know. I was just being polite."
"What do you want?" She cannot stop him now, though she tries. He leans into the door and it gives way. Her strength is a child's compared to his.
"You haven't heard from him?"
"Who?"
"Lewis, who else?"
"No, of course not." The door clicks closed.
"What's behind your back?"
She almost says nothing, but she knows that will only make him angry, will make him step toward her, grip her arm, and twist it into view. Slowly, she reveals the scissors.
"There's hair on these scissors."
"I was cutting my hair."
"That's not your hair. It's not the same color."
"Then I was trimming the clots off a stuffed ground sloth."
"I thought you said you were getting ready for bed."
"You ask too many questions."
"Do I? I have so many for you."
He snatches the scissors from her. His fingers, too fat, don't fit into the grip, so he must use two hands when he opens and closes them.
"Hold still a moment."
He steps close to her, and she slides back her feet, and he says,
"I said hold still."
She does as he says, but will not allow him to observe her fear. She crosses her arms and stares straight ahead when he circles her, teasing the blades across her shoulders, the back of her neck, down her arms. Finally, he chooses a section of sleeve, a moth's wing of fabric, that he snips away, and it disappears into his pocket. She prides herself on her strength, not just the muscles that ball in her arms, but her heart, her ability to bully back anyone who might take advantage of her. But she feels weak now. Slade makes her feel weak. She almost cries out for the boy. That will only make the situation worse, she knows, give Slade another target to prod with a blade, another line of questioning to delay his stay and renew his suspicion of her. But the scissors are so sharp, and his mouth is so close, his breath mingling with hers. She is close to kicking at his crotch, when just in time Slade drops the scissors. They clatter on the floor. He walks away. He opens the door and pauses at the threshold to regard her.
I could hurt you, you know, and nobody would stop me.
She has to swallow several times before she can say, I know.
Good.
He pulls the door behind him, his eye in the crack, the last thing she sees of him. Ella won't speak to Simon, not at first. He asks her what happened. He asks her, what's the matter? He asks, how can he help? She paces the hallway and then their room, stomping her feet, brushing a hand through her hair, slashing the air with the scissors. What? Simon says. And after a few minutes, she starts to talk under her breath, and Simon says, I can't hear you. And her voice grows louder and louder and comes out finally as a shout when she goes over all the things she should have said and done but didn't. He waits for her to finish and then says, I hate him too. This seems to irritate her, as if hatred were water and there was only so much to go around. You hate him? Why would you hate him? What do you even care? What does this have to do with you? When he says Slade killed his father, she tucks the scissors into her belt and says, Oh, I'll kill him for you. I'll kill him for both of us. For me? At first, she seems taken by the idea that he would offer such a thing. Then she is struck more by the absurdity than by the nobility of the gesture. You can't even climb a ladder without breaking your arm. You can't even tie your own shoe. You'll kill him? I'll kill him. I'll kill him my own damn self. He sees there is no reasoning with or comforting her, so he tries a method of thieving. Distraction and inertia. If you sneak up beside somebody and hold a rotten apple to their face, ask them to buy it, they'll naturally reel back, swing up their hands. With that momentum, he'll pop off a bracelet or slide coins from a pocket. He'll follow Ella's lead. How would you do it? You could stab him, sneak up behind him, and... Here he slashes at an invisible figure and makes a wet, shredding sound. No, she says and wrinkles her face. That wouldn't work. It wouldn't work at all. You'd have to get close and risk him grabbing hold of you. And he's too big. You'd have to stab him a million times, and you'd have to stab him with something long like a sword to even reach anything important. Then what? How would you kill him? I don't know. Maybe I'd push something out a window onto him, something heavy, an anvil, knock his brains out. Or poison. That wouldn't work either. Same as with the knife. He's too big. How much poison would it take to kill someone like that? A lot. And how do you camouflage a lot of poison? You can't just sprinkle it on a biscuit. You see, you need me. You can't think anything through on your own. Her tone has mellowed. Her mouth has risen into a smile. He has helped lag her fear. Not enough to get her to sleep, but enough to get her ready for it. They share the same room, their beds separated by a night table. They extinguish their lamps, and he lies there for a long time, listening to her breath, waiting for it to settle into the rhythm of sleep. Then she says, Simon?
What?
Thanks.
For what?
You know. He waits for her to say more, but she doesn't. Outside, the turbines turn and croak their lazy circles and sink them into sleep. The next morning, it takes him a moment to shake off his dreams, to orient himself in the museum, to recognize Ella spreading the curtains and letting in a slash of sunlight. He sees, then, his backpack, stained and patched, made mostly from canvas and bottomed with leather. He has asked for it many times, so many times that she has threatened to throw it away if he asks again, and now, here it is. The flap is open, as if it has disgorged all its contents on the floor. There is a blister pack of stainless steel nails, a chisel, a hammer, a faded rubber ducky with the beak hanging off, a rusted coil of wire, three sheets of sandpaper, a corroded butcher knife and metal spatula, three bottles of aspirin, and another for springtime allergies. She sits on the edge of the bed and folds her hands in her lap and asks if he sells these things, and he says yes. And she asks if people wonder where he finds them, and he says not really. Because
I'm a thief, you know? You don't want to ask too many questions when you're buying from a thief. You're not a thief. You're a grave robber. No, no. I steal from the living, too. He tells her that he can pick any lock, climb any wall, slip through any door or window in the sanctuary. This he says in a rush of pride and excitement, and then realizes whom he is speaking to, and goes quiet, and readies for a scolding. But she only tucks her hair behind her ears, a delicate gesture for her, and says, "What about that one?" She is talking about a photograph, discolored and bent in half, the picture flaking along the crease. A family on a sand dune. Two parents, three kids, all leaning into each other, their smiles bright and their hair windblown, while sunlight sparkles in a thousand crystalline points off the ocean behind them. "Why would you take this?" "I don't know." He crawls out of bed and squats to study the photo. "I guess I like the way it makes me feel when I look at it and hold it in my hand. It's like it's got this charge, a little life in it still." The mother appears to be laughing. One of the children, a boy, isn't looking at the camera at all, his eyes on a gull riding the breeze. Simon imagines the bones beneath their faces and wonders where they might be interred. This whole museum is a bit like that, don't you think? Ella studies him for a pregnant moment. Then she goes to the closet and swings open the door and pulls from beneath her clothes an old toy chest with a hinged lid and a rocking horse carved into the side. She shows him what she has never showed anyone, what she calls her dream box. Inside there are toy ponies, a pink plastic comb, a Renoir magnet, a pack of playing cards, an angel calendar, a yellowed copy of The Hobbit with the pages crumbling out of it, and more, much more, including a folder full of photos and clippings. She holds everything with the tips of her fingers, taking care not to bend or dirty them. He doesn't ask her why she has it, this box full of everything. He understands. They are the same, both refusing to acknowledge that they live in a place where fantasies must be discarded. Here is a vinyl record in a brittle paper sleeve. "François Hardy," it reads across it. Simon takes it from her. "Have you ever listened to this?"
"No."
"My father had records. He used to play."
"Your father?"
The danger of last night, which seemed so far removed a moment ago, now flashes across her face. She looks as though she might say something, but a tapping sound distracts her. They turn to the window, where Lewis's owl waits patiently beyond the glass. Chapter 22. His name is John Coulter, but for some time he was known as the Black Fist. He might have invented the name. He might have encouraged its use. He liked it. He felt it captured what he was, how he wanted others to consider him. Someone once told him the scariest part of any story was when a character crept forward to investigate a strange sound. Whatever nightmare waited around the corner did not matter. Its revelation almost always a disappointment. It was the imagined threat that mattered most. A fist was a threat, a clenched fist, raised and ready to swing. In this capacity, he served the sanctuary for many years. He began as a sentinel, and one day, when ranging the deadlands, he walked through the open door of a house that was a wolf's den. They sprung and burrowed their muzzles into him and mauled him nearly to death before the other sentinels fired arrows and sent them limping and yipping off. Eventually he healed, the scabs and then the scars hardening him back into the shape of a man. His mouth slashed open along the left cheek, a permanent half-smile. He sought out the wolves, hunting them down in their den, chaining them and whipping them into submission, making two of them his own, so that he would walk the streets leashed to them, first as a deputy, then as sheriff under the late Mayor Merriweather. Saddled on the back of a black horse called Nightmare and guided by his wolves, he now stalks his way across a parched country, a never-ending valley of the dry bones with no Ezekiel to call them up. He is schooled enough to know that God drove men west
Across the ocean, across America, they followed the compass of manifest destiny, and they claimed the country in God's name. But their God must not have been pleased, because he smote them down and cursed them with the hot wind breathed through his clenched teeth. The same breath that wakes Coulter tonight, on a farm outside of Omaha. He first hears the birds squawking and fluttering in the rafters of a pole shed, and then the hiss that swells into a sound like grain sliding down a metal chute. His horse whickers, and the wolves whimper and pant, and he hurries outside to see a vast section of the sky absent of stars. They have been eaten up by the black wall of sand moving toward him. He barricades the door and drapes blankets over the broken windows. When the sandstorm hits, the shed lets out a metallic groan as if ready to collapse, but it holds strong as the wind scours the metal and sends dust swirling through every available crack, and he and the wolves huddle down with their eyes pinched shut. He is not afraid, not of the heat, the emptiness, the radiation, the bone piles and splintery ruins, whatever danger awaits him. He prefers to imagine the world fearing him, as it was before, when he roamed the streets of the sanctuary, one hand leashed to the wolves, the other teasing the machete sheathed to his thigh. Everyone made way for him, darting down alleys, pressing their backs against buildings, closing their eyes if the wolves paused to sniff them. He was not a big man, but their fearfulness made him feel that way. Too big, so that he and the mayor began to thrash against each other, their tongues like quarreling daggers. He thought he knew one thing and the old man another. "You are the muscle, I am the brain." That's what the mayor always said, and Coulter came to reject it. He knew best which wards needed more or fewer patrols. He knew best what ordinances and punishments worked and didn't. After a heated city council session, after they closed the meeting and took to the hallway, after Merriweather jammed a finger against his chest and told him to stand down, Coulter lost his temper, twisted the old man's arm behind his back, and broke it with a damp pop. Not on purpose, by accident, if temper could be considered accidental. Sometimes the world felt like a game in which everyone vied for power. Those who didn't have power tried to maneuver or rage against those who did, and those who had power pushed to oppress further those who didn't. He played the game well, until he lost it. On the floor, with his arm bent unnaturally, the old man screamed and ordered Coulter's own deputies against him. He might have said sorry, if given the chance. But they silenced him by disappearing him into a cell. A few might have died dragging him there. And there he has remained, his anger growing viler and more toxic as time progressed. With chunks of stone and hunks of rusted metal, he sketched out on his cell wall scenes of war and torture. A fantasia of retribution that became his reality, like someone who reads over and over again a novel until its words are rote and its characters flesh. The old man who put him there is dead. The doctors said it was the result of infection brought on by the surgery, his arm broken in several places. The old man had been in a cast only a few days, racked by the fever that came from the infection when he suffered a heart attack. Coulter knew the heart attack could have come at any time, when he was giving a speech, or humping his wife, or knifing into a steak, whether his arm was broken or not. But all the what-ifs and maybes did not change the fact that his death, more or less, came at Coulter's hand. The mayor's son is alive, hiding somewhere out in all this waste. Coulter has been given a gift, the gift of freedom. They let him go, and wished him good hunting. Coulter knows how to hunt, and he knows how to hurt, with knives and ropes and whips and glass and fire, with his own hands, with his wolves. And now he is supposed to hurt Lewis, the man he still thinks of as a thin-wristed, pale-skinned weakling of a boy, the son of the man who clapped him away and left him to rot after all his years of service. He follows the dry river, follows the messy stream of hoofprints in the sand, follows the ashen piles of dead campfires, the withered lumps of stool, the castaway supplies the wolves sniff, lick. He squints at the horizon, where the sun sets, a kaleidoscope of bloody colors.
Chapter 23. Everyone calls her the doctor. She doesn't mind. She knows that once a woman becomes a certain age, people stop seeing her. In the sanctuary, at the hospital, people made eye contact, asked questions, listened to her answers, because she was of service to them. She was the doctor. But on the streets, she was no one. Invisible,